Product Stacks is brought to you by Storyblok, one of the world's fastest growing headless CMSs. A headless CMS like Storyblok separates the back end from the front end. By moving to an API-based CMS like Storyblok, you can publish your content to any front end, whether that's your marketing website or directly inside your product. Developers love Storyblok because they can use it with any front end framework they prefer and create components that can be reused anywhere as content blocks, cutting development time in half. Content teams are excited about the discussions feature built directly into Storyblok's visual editor. No more Slack or email threads to discuss content changes. Join 86,000 developers plus companies like Harvard Business School, Adidas, Netflix, Oatly, and Pizza Hut who all use Storyblok by trying a free demo at storyblok.com/departmentofproduct. Go to storyblok.com/departmentofproduct. That's Storyblok with a K at the end, /departmentofproduct. Joining us today on Product Stacks is Diego Rivas. So thanks very much, Diego, for taking some time out of your busy day to share some of the products that you work on. And if we just kick off with a bit of an introduction as to who you are and what types of products you work on.
Totally. Yeah. And thanks for having me, Richard. I'm excited to be here and happy to help. I am currently a product manager at Google, currently working in their augmented reality team in new immersive products. And my background is actually in mechanical engineering. So I started as an engineer working on consumer electronics and eventually decided to make the transition over to product management for a variety of different reasons, but really just at the core of it was that it was just what I was really more passionate about. And I started my product management career in Chrome OS, which is the operating system that we build at Google for notebooks and for the notebook ecosystem that we've been building historically for education in its majority. But then, you know, we've started to branch off into enterprise, into consumer as well. So worked on a variety of different initiatives there, all the way from new technologies or underlying technology stacks to new initiatives for the consumer market, like gaming, new form factors. So it was a very exciting time, and we'll chat through some of the products that I worked on there, at least at a high level. And then I made the change recently to the augmented reality team, and so that's where I am right now. So yeah, that's a little bit about my background.
Awesome. And you mentioned that you transitioned from engineering into product. How have you found that? Is it, if you had to compare the two, what things do you prefer about product versus engineering? What things perhaps don't you prefer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a hard call because there's so many fascinating kind of learning experiences that I had when I was an engineer, and I'm sure I would have continued to have in an engineering role. I think the core kind of distinction and the reason that kind of drew me into product management was that I was really always fascinated by the why of solving building a product or solving a product problem. And I kind of was trying to continue to push for that when I was working as an engineer. And then eventually I realized that if that's really what was calling my passion, I think it was probably best that I continued my career as a product manager. And to this day, I still partner very closely with engineers, and I absolutely love that part of my job.
And is at Google, is there a general rule that PMs must be technical or must come from a technical background? I know that was a prerequisite at some point. Is that still the case?
I think it's generally at a high level, the part where that becomes more particularly helpful is if you're having conversations with engineers, if you're having conversations about prioritization, if you're having conversations about strategy mapping, et cetera, it helps to have some kind of technical context when you start to make some of those decisions. So then you enter those conversations with an informed point of view of, you know, what is the scope of something that you're talking about? Or, you know, if you're evaluating a trade-off, do you have some kind of like at least high level information that gives you more tools to provide to make a decision there? That being said, like, you know, it's in all the different projects that I've worked in, and I would say this is fairly consistent in many different instances, when you move teams or products or when you enter even a new company, you're not going to know everything about the technology. You're not going to know everything on the technical stack. So a lot of it is just partnering really closely with your engineering teams and accepting that it's it's part of the learning journey, but it's also not the expectation that you have to be at the same level as the engineering team.
It's often very difficult as a product manager to know like what level of technical depth to go down. So I've worked with PMs who have come from engineering backgrounds, and sometimes that can be a really good thing. And sometimes it can actually be a little bit of a hindrance because they get very excited about the how. So an opportunity arises and then they go immediately into thinking about how that solution might be built because they're able to. And then if you contrast that sometimes with PMs who come from more of a maybe a marketing background, they have kind of very little to no knowledge of how it's going to be built, but they're fixated on the why. But that can also throw up problems, as you say, because if you're trying to, if you're working with engineers and you have zero technical knowledge at all, then you know, it can be very difficult to manage scope and things like that.
That's spot on. I think that's one of the core challenges when you switch from engineering to product, because it's just, you know, comes the framework that you've been using, exactly, that you've been using to think about things. So yeah,
perfect. So the three, before we delve into your product stack, we thought we could take a look at three main areas. The first is roadmap and strategy, the second is your team setup, and the third is your software development process. So just at a high level, how do you approach things like roadmap and strategy?
So I think one of the core tools that is pretty consistently used across, and I think this is not Google specific, but certainly very true and consistent across the Google culture, is OKRs. And OKRs really drive a lot of the roadmap planning. And I think I always view them as a tool that helps kind of bring organization to some of the roadmap and some of the strategy pieces that you're building out. So the way that that's typically framed is you'll have your objective layer, which I would say it's more tied to the vision slash mission. So the blue circle over here, and that's really about why you're building what you're building. That's, you know, more, it can be more on the aspirational side. It can be more on the, I would say almost like motivational side for teams at times. And it should be ideally, you know, there should be some links to overall kind of product area priorities or even Google-wide priorities. So that function is almost as like, in a sense, your North Star objective, or, yeah, you know, of course there can be many of them, but just as it can be your guiding function almost.
Yep.
The key results tend to be more of the strategy components and how actually you make those happen. So in this particular context, I would say, you know, and it depends on the type of product, but sometimes you could have your business and product strategy, like they don't necessarily have to be like one inclusive of the other, or they don't necessarily have to be like sequential. I think they can be intertwined in different ways. So your key results really function as, yeah, exactly. So your key results really function as sort of core pieces that guide that strategy. And those are really more about how are we actually getting things done? And, you know, there's a higher level kind of interim component of what you're actually doing, which is could be like the higher level strategy. But the way that that strategy is implemented is really kind of explained or broken down in your key results.
And does each product manager have their own set of key results, or is it set at a team level or a department level? Like how do key results get set?
Yeah. So maybe I think more relevant in this context, you typically have it at, you know, team level or product level, or even like business area level. So there's definitely kind of like, you can go higher level into the stack, if you will, depending on which kind of part of the team you're in. You can also have your own personal OKRs, and it's also a fairly common tool to sort of help guide, you know, whether your career trajectory or whether just simply guide kind of like your priorities. Yeah. But in the context of this specifically, it tends to be more at the team level. And, you know, it could be a team that is more at the, like I mentioned, like more at the business kind of, or what we call product area type scale, or it could be more like a much more kind of specific team size that is, you know, very much deliberately focused on a particular area of the product.
And so the second area that we're interested in is the team setup itself. If there is such a thing, what does a team look like, or what does your team look like, and how does that compare with the rest of Google?
Yeah, so I would caveat it by saying that this can be a little bit dependent on the type of product that you're building.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, in some instances, like there could be even more post-its here that, you know, cover business partnerships, cover go-to-market team, cover more like partner facing teams in general. But in other cases, like you may have, you know, more, let's say like research/data scientist type roles. So I think it really depends on the type of product. The one that I would say, or like the pillars that I would say are fairly consistent across the board are, of course, engineering. And this can be, you know, across multiple parts of the stack. So it can be all the way from user experience engineer to, you know, a backend style engineer to hardware engineering to kind of like suites that may work in different types or different parts of the stack. So I think it's, you know, it's such a broad realm of kind of levels of expertise and ownership. So these, you know, yellow post-its can really like be super broad depending on the type of product that you're working on. The UX side, I would say, is the other, you know, really consistent bit. I would break that down into different types of UX or different types of design components. Like you may have interaction design as an example that tends to be, you know, a fairly kind of consistent role across products that you work in, particularly consumer facing products. I think UX design in general, UX research is another core component that will almost always be there in some form. And that's, you know, one of the core areas that you work with to kind of deep dive into the insights of the problem area that you're trying to solve. So I think it'll, and you know, this could branch off into, there may be more specialized areas, like maybe there's like human computer interaction design or things of that nature. So I think that at a high level, the UX and engineering pillars will always be there. The breadth of them will be, you know, depending on the type of product, may be very different, and you may have more specialized roles depending on the type of the product that you interface with closely, like we were mentioning, the research side, you know, partnership side, legal side, etc. But those are some of the core pillars that I would highlight.
And is there a split between product management and, say, product owner or project management?
Yeah, it's a good question, and maybe that's another post that should also exist here. So generally speaking, maybe it just is in an ideal scenario, let's say you will probably also have some form of program management or technical program manager or engineering program manager. Like they may have different kind of ownership areas, but I think the core kind of distinction, at least from what I have seen in my personal opinion, is that the PM, PGM type role is really at the core of the organizational piece. It's really at the core of like orchestrating, like from a schedule perspective, from like a deprioritization perspective, like that's really kind of like the core role that helps manage all of that component. Mm-hmm. Generally, maybe a little bit less facing, or less, let's say, UX facing, or less facing towards like the defining the why of the product, for example. That's more on the PM side, on the product management side. But I would say, like, you know, this is very much case by case dependent. So in some cases, product management can absorb some of the responsibilities of PGM/GPM, depending on the scale of the team. So it's really dependent on the case, but this is just like a sample scenario, I would say.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Perfect. And then the final part of this is just the software development process. So some people we've spoken to use like 2-week sprints. Some people use 1-week sprints. Some people use Kanban and a mixture of other things. Do you have like a software development process that you follow, or does it change per team? And what do you do in your team?
Yeah, it also changes quite a bit per team. Yeah. I'd maybe abstract this to hardware and software, just because in my personal case, I've also worked a lot in hardware. I think there's maybe just at a very abstracted level, there's probably a stage where you're doing more kind of early stage prototyping of some form. And that's really about rapid prototyping and iterating and leveraging, you know, tools that are available, in some cases, kind of benchmarking, you know, competitive devices or benchmarking competitive solutions and software, and maybe even kind of like building sort of retrofitted prototypes, like hacky prototypes, especially if the intent is to move quick and understand and like build on certain baselines. I think that's where that becomes particularly helpful. So that's really like the early stage, rapid and iterative process. Then I think when that stage is like, you know, well after that stage, it's a much more structured approach, I would say, at a high level. Like you'll typically have, you know, forms of milestones, and depending on the teams, these can be very different, but they can be, for example, like feature freeze milestones. They can be some form of quality testing kind of realms that you need to give yourself, or kind of time periods that you need to give yourself. So there's almost like a QA milestone of some sort that you need to hit. And, you know, if things kind of ship with following software releases, then it's a lot more about understanding when are the feature freeze dates for those releases. How do you, again, work with like your program management team and your engineers to understand what the intersection points are, what the risk levels are. So I think at a high level, the way that I would summarize this is when you're not in the kind of early stage prototyping form, which is, I would say, more unstructured because you don't necessarily need to follow an externally facing release cadence. I think when you are in the more structured phase, it's just a lot about kind of understanding what the high level milestones are in the software release cadence and why those milestones are there. Like, what does it mean for a feature freeze state to be at a certain date? And why is it, you know, X number of days or months or weeks before, like, when it actually gets to a user? Like, understanding what happens between that, understanding the quality testing or just compatibility testing that goes between that. I think all of those components tend to be in place. So it's just helpful to understand them as part of the development process of your product.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's interesting that your role potentially spans across both hardware and software from what you were saying.
Yeah.
Does that create like dependencies? So that if the hardware is ready, but the software is not, or do you have to kind of create joint timelines that eliminate dependencies? And how does it work, like bridging the gap between hardware and software? I can imagine that's extremely challenging.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would say very much the case. There's certainly some form of dependency, and I would argue the dependencies can be on both sides depending on what part of the build you're in. So maybe just abstracting an example and kind of like speaking at a high level, if you're running on a hardware build schedule, which may typically tend to be pretty far out compared to software timelines, you still will have some form of like software readiness that you'll need that's tied to those hardware builds. So say, you know, if you're building something at a factory, there may be a date by when you need that factory software or that software in the factory to be ready. And depending on the prototype stage, like you may be okay with certain levels of kind of like functionality or reliability. Like maybe in the earlier stages, you say, well, we know that we have all of these bugs or all of these kind of issues at this stage, but that's okay. Like our focus is really to get the hardware out, for example, or our focus is really to test a specific component. But then as you get, you know, further ahead in your builds for the hardware, that's when, you know, the quality testing component and the just more comprehensive kind of understanding of what issues exist out there, what's the path to close them? Can you close them by the time the product launches? And ultimately, like working backwards from what are deadlines that are very much not movable. Like an example that comes up often is there are things that just simply are out of your control. Like if there's a conference that you want to announce a product at, or there's a retail cycle that you want to launch a product in, say that you want to have a product out by Christmas, or you want to have a product out by Black Friday or whatever. Those you can't really control or move. So yeah. those are fixed, you know, external dates.
And is that like one team? Or, I mean, I guess you've got software engineers and hardware engineers. And would you as the product would you be working in one single team together, or would you have to kind of bridge the gap between those two things?
I would say, it depends on the size of the team and the product. Typically, I would say like it's fairly common to have a team of product, like you'll have a product lead overall, but you'll have a set of product managers, and there will be some that may be more focused on the software, some that may be more focused on the hardware. Some eventually, if the product is, you know, kind of at a large scale, you may have like subsets of that. So you may have like owners for product iteration or for product kind of generation. So I think it depends on the scale of the product, but you know, it can vary in that sense.
Okay, perfect. Awesome. Yeah, that's really, really, really helpful to get a really broad bit of context and a wider understanding of how you do product specifically in your teams. Shall we take a look at some of the products that you've chosen for your product stack?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sounds good.
Should we start with the first one?
Yeah. One of the products that I wanted to chat through, I think maps really well to this framework that I wanted to just discuss. And I think, you know, for anybody that's worked in product in the past, this may be some of these will be kind of intuitive, but this came up in one of the product areas that I was owning some time ago, which was related to kind of like a core technology or an underlying technology in one of the past teams that I was working at. And the reason why this had surfaced was because I came in, again, from that transition from engineering, and it was kind of very natural for me to jump directly, like you were saying, Richard, into how do I build something or what am I building in certain cases. But it was less intuitive to jump, kind of take a step back and say, well, why are we building this? And so one of the I guess this is, I would preface this by saying this was like a low level technology that enabled, you know, different types of experiences in ecosystem, just at a high level. Yeah. Keep it high level just so we can chat through some of the learnings. So I think this applies pretty consistently to anything that is very technology heavy or very kind of deep into the technology stack, maybe in the low level stack, and may not be as kind of high level like app layer or user facing. So the reason why I had mapped this was just to kind of like stay grounded on, well, here are some of the pieces that I'm noticing, and here are some of the pieces that, you know, I think we can kind of like just take it back to first principles and go through what are we actually kind of like trying to drive as PMs. So if we start in the upper left corner, this is the kind of core area that I wanted to always bring myself back to, which is let's bring it back to product principles and what's really the user story behind something. Even if you enter the team and you're handed off, you know, or you're handed a technology to own, and there's already a technology roadmap, I think it's always helpful as an exercise to kind of pressure test that a little bit and understand where did this kind of why come from originally? Like where is the user story behind this decision and what you actually enable with this decision? And that's where this red text over here that I had made as a note as I was kind of like going through some of the learnings in the process of what I was looking at. This becomes particularly challenging when there are more technology-based solutions. And so an example is, you know, let's say that you're working on a part of the stack, like I mentioned, that is lower level, like you're working on something that is more at the firmware level. Let's say if you're working on some form of hardware, or you're working something on the back related to the back end, like a back end improvement, for example. I think it's at times it's a little bit harder to link it back to what's the user impact, what's the story, or it may not be as intuitive. But I think as PMs, you know, this is an exercise that becomes particularly helpful because then that drives the rest of this diagram. Like then you work from that and then you know, is there something that I should sort of change as an assumption in my process? So the tools that we use for this, I think these are pretty, you know, fairly standard, but just I'll highlight them as an example. Typically, you know, writing product requirement docs or PRDs, this is really about what are your product requirements and why, and how do they link to the pain points that you're trying to solve? The second tool that's fairly common, at least that we use internally, are one-pagers. And those are really more summarized versions of, I think these are particularly helpful just to be more concise in whether you're driving a decision or whether you are kind of informing a part of the product strategy. These are not intended to be as comprehensive as the PRDs, but they intend to be like much more deliberately concise. You can have, you know, smaller form reviews or smaller form decisions. And then, you know, strategy docs, which can evolve in different ways.
Just a quick question on that then. So I'm guessing that for PRDs versus one pages versus strategy docs, there's different audiences for each of those different types of docs. Could you kind of elaborate on who, when those different types of documents might be suitable for which audience?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the audiences can be a little bit broad for PRDs at times. And I'll give an example. Like if you're in an early stage definition of your product, you may actually write a PRD to get feedback from different parts of the team. You may write a PRD to get alignment. You may write a PRD to drive engineering decisions. It can, generally speaking, it can be kind of like a central reference for a lot of other sort of derivative documents. So a feature tracker or a decision process or a leadership review, or, you know, even just like historical retrospectives. Like if a project gets canceled down the line, there may be, you know, an intent to look back and say, oh, how were we thinking about this product back then? So the audience can be so broad and the intent can be, you know, so so broad as well. Like, so it can just be so different depending on who's actually reading it, which is why they tend to be pretty broad and they tend to encompass a lot of different components. But at the core of it is just, what are the requirements of what we're trying to build and how do they connect to the pain points and the user story and the user narrative? The one pagers can be a little bit more specific, and the audiences can be, I'll get specific examples that I've gone through in the past. I've used one pagers to get, kind of team alignment with marketing or team alignment with, say, engineering and, kind of feature prioritization, for example. There can be different types of level of technical depth into the one pagers or level of abstraction into the one pager. So it can vary quite a bit, but generally speaking, more concise and deliberate. The strategy docs, I think, maybe more relevant for, say, leadership reviews, maybe more relevant for staffing conversations, and more relevant for prioritization. So maybe, when I say leadership, it can extend from technical leadership to business leadership to product leadership. So it's more, I think those are more about either informing or kind of driving a decision and just kind of, having a conversation that's based around like a specific strategy decision that you're making at your product stage. So yeah, that's at a high level how I would think about the distinction.
Perfect. Yeah, that's really helpful.
So the next one is, so when you work from the why, then you move on to, well, okay, what are we actually building? This is the tool that I was referring to earlier on OKRs. And then the idea is that the what should actually then move you on to, okay, how are we building what we're building? And by the way, just a quick note, a lot of this was inspired in this book called Start With Why. A high recommendation on the product management, I think on any product manager's list, but there's a lot of kind of talk about this, why versus how versus what. So that's, if you see some similarities, that's kind of deliberate. So yeah, then you move to, okay, how are we actually building this into work streams, and what is the actual kind of how of what, how we get from that vision, a strategy to like a more material output. I think one of the notes that I made here as a learning is coming into this stage with a strong stance in product decisions. And by strong, I really mean like a deliberate sort of decision on trade-offs. Like, it's a lot harder to say, here are the things that we are not going to do, rather than to say, here are more things that we're going to do. And so I think coming in with like that really strong perspective, or like really established and aligned ideally perspective of, here are the things that are not a priority. And maybe there will be a priority for the next product generation, but here are the things that like for now, we're not focusing on these work streams. That tends to be really helpful to just, facilitate this. And otherwise, if you work back into the first stage, it becomes a lot harder to say, well, why? Like, where did this come from? If there's a work stream that's not linking to the why, then that kind of breaks this flow.
Perfect. Just a quick question on the why. So you've decided that, you put together this amazing kind of story about why you're deciding to build something, but where does that actually start? What's the genesis for like a new product idea, or does it come from multiple places?
Yeah, it can stem from a variety of different places, but I'll give you some examples. And I think this is, to be honest, like one of the really empowering parts of the product management role at times, is that you can start with something as simple as an observation or a hypothesis, and maybe it's based on market data, maybe it's based on a trend that you're noticing in the market, maybe it's based on you simply noticing things in the world and you're like, this shouldn't be done this way, this needs to change, or this is a pain point that I'm noticing that, is fairly recurring. So in that sense, it's almost like you are your like product visionary type role. You're wearing that type of hat in that sense. There can be other examples, there may be factors around, a broader strategy direction within the company or within the product area. Like maybe we want to, as a random example, maybe we want to grow in a specific market. Maybe we want to tackle a different type of use case. Maybe we, have a different company priority. So those factors also become particularly important in that kind of like genesis. And then the other one, I would say in an ideal scenario with enough time and with enough resources, you should have a structure that you're validating all of these assumptions and testing them out with user research and testing them out by talking to, potential users or by just, you know, going out there and whether interviewing or just simply talking to people, you know, running observation methods and working with your XR team to do that. I think that tends to be also kind of like a core part of the genesis of that idea.
Perfect.
So those are examples.
A question on user research and usability testing before, like validating things before you build them. In a hardware context, how does that work? How are you able to test things on actual customers from outside of Google, or how does it work?
Are you saying because of confidentiality or because?
Yeah, if you're working on like a top secret AR headset, for example, I'm not saying then if you, you know, how would you validate something like that? How would you test it? Would you just get people to sign NDAs or would you just test it internally? How does that work?
Yeah, really good question. I think there are, there's been kind of externally shared approaches on how we've done this in the past as well. But in some cases, I think there's a deliberate intent, if the product is very confidential, to start the testing internally and do user testing, whether it's like, there's different terms that we use internally. It could be team recruiting, it could be dog recruiting, much broader kind of user base, but that they all tend to be internally focused user testing. The problem that you run into with that approach eventually, at some point, depending on your product, is that you have some kind of form of representative sample, but you don't really have like the broadest representative sample. And for example, if you're trying to, you know, test a new market, or if you're trying to test different particular type of user groups, like it may actually make more sense to start to actually test it with those user groups and start to actually put it in real world scenarios. So there are guidelines there that, you know, should be followed in terms of ensuring confidentiality, following the right principles around privacy, following the right principles around just the readiness of the hardware. There may be like some form of training that is required, et cetera. So there are tools and processes to run those externally if needed, but in many cases, I think the start can be internal.
Perfect. That's really, really interesting. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. So then you go into your how, and I had mentioned, you know, typically organized by PGM/TPMs, but really the core of this execution is eng teams, technical leadership teams, technical managers. You know, there could be design documents, which are effectively like much more in-depth technical documents that, you know, go well beyond the PRD, typically in technical depth in terms of how we're building, what we're building, and they can function almost as like a central sort of like source of truth of some of the pieces that are being built in a specific part of the project. They can be, you know, different forms of kind of submitting code. There can be different forms of tracking issues or bugs. So anyways, that's at a high level, those are the pieces there. And then, you know, this goes hand in hand with more organizational pieces here at the bottom right, which is what the PGM/GPM would own. So a tracker, a dashboard, hot list, you know, bug burn down, et cetera. So the different types of terminology that you could use there, but at a high level, that's kind of like, you know, how that organization back and forth happens. So one of the other, I think, kind of core pieces that tends to happen between the why, what, and the how is, in, I had mentioned the partnership example. In many cases, you may also have a partner that you work with to actually make your product successful. And, you know, in the Chrome OS example that I had given, which was like the team that I was working on in the past, you know, you very much have a strong partnership ecosystem, and, you know, you very much work with your partners to be successful and to bring your ideas to life. So that becomes a really core component. And I think in that process, it's key to work with them and ensure that, you know, the vision is well-defined, you're starting with the why, and ensuring that you're not kind of working backwards from this step back to the why, but rather that there's kind of like a conversation from first product principles and the user story of what you're trying to build. So it tends to be an iterative approach, and there tends to be kind of, this is where the more business/partnership type conversations tend to happen. And yeah, and I think probably the last component that I would highlight, and by the way, this, you know, framework is of course super high level. There are a lot of other variations here. You know, there's marketing, there's legal, there's a bunch of different aspects that are not covered here. But the last kind of component within this high level framework is staffing and resourcing becomes, you know, a particularly important one. Like if you if you know about the why, if you know about the what, and you have this scope and you have these OKRs, you have the sort users, an example of what may happen is you realize that the scope is not something that's manageable with the team that you have. So there may be staffing conversations required, and that's when you have different forms of leadership reviews, and you may have decisions around prioritization, deprioritization. You may have decisions around trade-offs. You may have decisions around growing a team. So that tends to be also in many cases driven by product leads, in some cases technical managers as well, or technical leads as well. So at a high level, these are some of the components that may come into play in these kind of like more technically in-depth type product areas.
Yep, that's really, really, really helpful. Thanks very much. Yeah. And so for each of these areas, are there specific tools and products that you use? Are you all using like Google G Suite, I guess, for everything? Or do you get freedom to use other things? Do you want to use other things? Like how, if you were doing like your PRDs, your one pages and your strategy,
yeah,
for example, I'm guessing it's all in G Suite.
Yeah, I mean, the core of the tools that we use are workspace driven. Unless there's a specific tool that, unless there's a specific tool that you need around, let's say if you're a designer or if you have a particular, need that doesn't run on our internal tooling, that may be an exception. But at the core of a lot of the tools that I had mentioned, or a lot of the artifacts or a lot of the items that I had mentioned in that diagram, the core of it is using some form of workspace tool or some form of internal kind of organizational tool.
I noticed recently you can insert like these little new components, almost like, so like you can include like drop downs now. They're kind of basically stealing stuff from Notion and making it more Notionified. It looks good.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Like the power that you get from some of these tools is actually truly amazing when you start to deep dive into it.
Yeah.
Slides is probably Docs and Slides is probably my go-to one. It's hard to say that because I use Sheets quite often for everything that has to do with tracking, laying out features, feature roadmaps. I think, Sheets becomes a lot more of a handy tool there, but Slides just tends to be a really quick way to throw down ideas, visualize, organize. I think it can serve a variety of different purposes and sometimes can be quick use, sometimes can be more kind of in-depth use.
One of the tools that's come out really popular with PMs that we've spoken to is Smart Sheets. Do you guys use Smart Sheets at all? I guess everything is done on G Sheets.
I've been in projects where I've seen it used before. I think it's a good question. It's like, what drives the need to use that versus not?
Yeah.
I think in some cases, like it can be something as simple as like right now we're talking through Zoom, and I think that it may just be like, if you're working, let's say with a partner and they have like a specific access structure within their kind of company or within their realm to a specific tool rather than another one, like that may be an area where we actually kind of decide to align on that. So that's very much like, I think in partnership areas, there's very much like scenarios where we have to like use other tools in some cases if needed. But yeah. I think at an internal level, I would say fairly consistent to leverage the tools that we have.
And on a personal level, are there tools that you find really useful in your day-to-day role that you think, I really couldn't live without this? And they're worth sharing with our audience. Like, are there any like people like used to use like productivity tools? Like I mentioned Notion. Are there any little like apps or tools that you use, anything in your day-to-day role that's not necessarily an internal tool, but it's something that you couldn't live without? Some people have just said pen and paper as well, by the way.
This is probably a different type of answer that the one that I think you were looking for. But I think one of the most helpful pieces to me, I think the impact of being able to have your work consistently on the cloud, the impact of being able to access from anywhere. So I personally, because I used to work on the Chrome OS team in the past, I was trying, let's say, different types of notebooks when they were when they were coming out as prototypes. And being able to just very quickly hop on to a new notebook and being able to just, continue my work stream without having to deal, like just almost instantaneously, without having to deal with any sort of syncing or anything like that, that takes a ton of time. Like that is, I think we take that for granted quite a bit. And it's just pretty magical.
It's magic.
Yeah. And by the way, like I would take that even to more form factors. Like I sometimes need to check something on my phone, like if it's a document of some sort or something like that. And having that kind of like almost immediate link to that content becomes, you know, pretty magical as well. So I'm super excited about that evolving in whatever form it does, but that's been kind of like probably one of the most helpful components across all this tooling.
Perfect. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. I saw a video on, I think it was on Twitter, where somebody copied something from their iPad with like a finger swipe and then pasted it onto their from their iPhone onto their iPad. And they were like, why doesn't Apple give us instructions on how to do these types of things? There's so many magical cross-device things you can do. I think people don't fully realize what's possible. But I completely agree that, you know, the magic of having everything synced up is just something that we take for granted now. So much friction that's been eliminated from our lives. There's literally nothing left to remove. And you know, when the AR devices take over, we're going to be we're not going to be human anymore. But we'll leave that to you.
But I agree. I think it's those magical moments. I think are one of the most exciting parts of working on products like these, and being able to just like ultimately rethink whatever has been the status quo in some experiences, computing experiences for us, and being able to make them better, I think is, you know, so impactful. So that's an area that I'm particularly excited about.
Perfect. Well, Diego, thanks very much for spending some time with us today to talk through your product processes and your tools. If people want to follow you, is there any places for people to do that? Could be on LinkedIn or Twitter or anything, anywhere else?
Yeah, I would say LinkedIn is a good start. Diego Rivas at LinkedIn.
Perfect. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Cool. Thanks, Richard.